Introduction to Alan's talk on Signs of the Times, he's asked that we read Psalm 72. Give the king thy judgments, O God, and thy righteousness unto the king's son. He shall judge thy people with righteousness, and thy poor with judgment. The mountain shall bring peace to the people, and the little hills by righteousness. He shall judge the poor of the people. He shall save the children of the needy, and shall break in pieces the oppressor. They shall fear thee as long as the sun and moon endure throughout all generations. He shall come down like rain upon the mown grass, as showers that water the earth. In his days shall the righteous flourish, and abundance of peace so long as the moon endureth. He shall have dominion also from sea to sea, and from the river unto the ends of the earth. They that dwell in the wilderness shall bow before him, and his enemies shall lick the dust. The kings of Tarshish and of the isles shall bring presents. The kings of Sheba and Seba shall offer gifts. Yea, all kings shall fall down before him. All nations shall serve him. For he shall deliver the needy when he crieth, the poor also, and him that hath no helper. He shall spare the poor and the needy, and shall save the souls of the needy. He shall redeem their soul from deceit and violence, and precious shall their blood be in his sight. And he shall live, and to him shall be given of the gold of Sheba. Prayer also shall be made for him continually, and daily shall he be praised. There shall be a handful of corn in the earth upon the top of the mountains. The fruit thereof shall shake like Lebanon, and they of the city shall flourish like grass of the earth. His name shall endure forever. His name shall be continued as long as the sun, and men shall be blessed in him. All nations shall call him blessed. Blessed be the Lord God, the God of Israel, who only doeth wondrous things. And blessed be his glorious name for ever. Let the whole earth be filled with his glory. Amen and amen. The prayers of David, the son of Jesse, are ended. Now my pleasure then to ask Brother Alan to speak to us on Signs of the Times.
Well, good evening, brethren and sisters. Well, as you've probably gathered, there's absolutely no shortage of Signs of the Times to talk about this night. And of course, it was 12 months ago that I was here before. So what a year it's been. Now, we're going to change the order tonight, because usually you probably recall that we start with Ezekiel 38 and we go on usually ending up with Britain and Europe. But sometimes the Britain and Europe part gets truncated towards the end. And I think that it's really very significant what's happened between Britain and Europe this year, or at any rate what's started to happen. So we're going to deal with that first and move on to Ezekiel 38 and the Prince of Rosh afterwards. So our first section is called Britain and Europe. And we've just read Psalm 72. The reason I had that read was because you've got that lovely verse 10 there. And of course, this is talking about Messiah's triumphal reign from Jerusalem, isn't it? But verse 10, the kings of Tarshish and of the isles shall bring presents. The kings of Sheba and Seba shall offer gifts. Now, it's only one verse, four lines, but it's very, very important, because what that tells us about Tarshish is that it's an island kingdom, and it's friendly towards the Lord Jesus Christ. It brings the Lord Jesus Christ presents alongside with Sheba, which is Saudi Arabia, as opposed to the nations which are recorded in the other nations recorded in Ezekiel 38 and Joel and Revelation 17, which make war either with God's land or with the Lord Jesus Christ himself. So the kings of Tarshish and of the isles shall bring presents. So there's no doubt that Tarshish is an island kingdom, an island power. And it's a very great proof that Britain is indeed Tarshish. It's amazing, really. Quite a few brethren have said to me, well, I think Tarshish is Spain. Well, it just doesn't stand up, because Spain isn't an island, for a start off. And then if you say Tarshish is Spain, where do the young lions fit in? Because that only fits in with Britain as the head of formerly the empire and now of the Commonwealth, and it fits exactly. It all absolutely fits, and I've never had any doubt in my own mind that Tarshish, this island kingdom, is Britain, and the young lions are the Commonwealth states. And of course, the young lion come of age is the United States of America, which will certainly be there in Ezekiel 38. So then we come on to our overheads, and there we go. Right, well, we're going back to the first great earthquake of this year. I'm going to call that. There are two great earthquakes concerning Britain this year. That's the first one, May the 7th, the general election. Now, the sweetest victory. Nobody expected it to go the way it did. It was completely unexpected. In fact, on the day before the election, a very canny Scottish gentleman went into a bookies and said, what odds will you give me for an absolute Conservative majority? And they said, 7-1 against. Okay, he says, here's a cheque for £30,000. Day after the general election, he picked up his cheque for £210,000. But to the great majority of the people in this country, it was an absolute shock. To David Cameron, it was a shock because he'd already written his resignation speech. He'd written his resignation and was ready to deliver it, from just before 10 o'clock. And then, of course, the poll came through. And Miliband and Clegg were absolutely convinced. Nick Clegg had he'd worked out that although they were going to lose quite a lot of seats, they'd probably end up with 30 seats, which would give them enough to form another coalition. They'd started off with 58 seats, and he thought, we'll get half of those. Well, it was a wipeout, wasn't it? From 58 seats, they ended up with 8. It was a complete and utter shock. Miliband also had written his victory speech, ready to give it to the nation. But at 2 minutes to past 10, as the poll came through on the TV, he ripped up his speech and threw it into the waste paper basket. But of course, it was the hand of God, wasn't it? And so, what's God done? Well, the God and the angels have put in a government that has got the capability to take Britain out of Europe. Because in the manifesto, the Conservatives said, well, we'll hold a referendum of the people. We'll negotiate some terms first. Finally, we'll put these terms to the people, and they can either vote, yes, we accept the revised terms, or no, we want out, we want to leave Europe. And of course, the way things are going, this referendum could be as early as 2016. Now, I want to emphasise at this stage that we don't know whether Britain will come out of Europe or not, because it's not clear from Bible prophecy. It could be that right up to the Ezekiel 38 scenario, Britain then could still be a member of Europe but would break away from the views of Europe. On the other hand, it could be that we're now moving towards a position where Britain will leave Europe. So, you know, I hope you will be able to, you know, take these remarks in this context, so that it looks to me, the way that things are moving, it looks to me as if we could well come out of Europe, but we can't be dogmatic, but we can only look at the evidence and see how events are unfolding. But indeed, what a sign. Well, now we come on to great earthquake number two, Jeremy Corbyn. The great earthquake of Saturday the 11th of September, when Jeremy Corbyn was elected as leader of the Labour Party by an overall majority of 52%. Now, if that canny Scottish gentleman had gone into a bookies a month before this, he'd have got odds of 200 to 1 against Corbyn becoming leader. And as a matter of fact, he had to have 35 signatures in order to go on the ballot paper. By the last day, he'd only got 34. And it was only at 1 minute to 12 that he managed to get the 35th vote to put him on the paper. Because the Corbyn side had run a very clever campaign, and they said, well, look, he's got absolutely no chance of winning. But to be fair, to show that the Labour Party is inclusive, he ought really to be on the ballot paper because, he puts forward a certain view. And so, of course, most of these 35 who nominated him, they absolutely didn't think there was any possibility of him becoming leader. They just, we'll put his name down. It won't happen. And even Corbyn's supporters themselves said, it's not going to happen. But of course, it did. But it's the angels at work again, isn't it? Absolutely. Of course, he's been shown to be a divided force in the party. On the shoot to kill earlier in the last week, he refused to back that in Britain if there were terrorists and was derided for it. He wants to ban Trident and the other half of his party doesn't. But he's got enormous support still, and 66% of the Labour Party still back him from the latest poll, which was taken in the last couple of days. So now it would be absolutely impossible to get rid of him, because if another election was run, you would have exactly the same result. But nationally in the country, the result is different. The latest poll shows that the poll will now be Conservatives 42% and Labour 27%. And basically, it's an outcome which would, some think, will put in a Conservative government for at least the next 10 years. So there we are. So why is Corbyn there? Well, I still think it's because of Europe, because originally he's always been a Eurosceptic. And he voted no in the 1975 referendum. He voted to reject the terms. He's always been a Eurosceptic, but he was persuaded to fall into line by his party when he became leader, but reluctantly. But he has said that if there was any legislation which came up from Europe which would prejudice Labour Party, prejudice union membership or anything like that, he would definitely vote to come out. So maybe that's the reason he's there. He's certainly there for a purpose. But indeed, how God works in the kingdoms of men. Right, well, on to the actual campaign about leaving Europe. There we're talking about the CBI. The CBI, that's an article which appeared a week ago. CBI, of course, is the Confederation of British Industry. Now, for the last 4 years, the CBI has been absolutely 100% in favour of Britain remaining in Europe. And the head of the CBI until a week ago was John Crigland, who absolutely thought that Europe was definitely the best thing since sliced bread. And in fact, he stifled Eurosceptic opposition from certain member firms. But at this meeting, which was held a week ago, and there's Cameron addressing it, there was a revolt by heads of companies who wanted to leave Europe. And they created such a fuss in the conference hall that they were let in. And they heckled David Cameron as he made his speech. So there is a significant membership of British industry and British industry leaders which definitely want to leave Europe. Well, there's a new head of the CBI now, There she is, Caroline Fairburn. Just appointed, she was appointed a week yesterday. And she has said, look, we've got to take on board the anti-European business leaders as well. We've got to take them on board. She said that. She's prepared, she said, to look at both sides. Now, this is quite an important development, that the head of the CBI, which is a very, very important body in England, very influential with the government, has now started to say, well, hang on, there's two sides to this question. There are definitely two points of view. And so that's the way things are starting to move in that direction. And there you've got some heads of British industry. You perhaps don't know many of them, but... well, there's Lord Carnes, who was the founder of Dixon's, and there's John Mills, who was part of the Littlewoods empire. But basically, they're amongst the businessmen who are heading the Vote Leave campaign. The Vote Leave campaign. Now, in this referendum campaign, there are going to be two organisations which are going to be appointed by the government as the official Yes and the official Want to Leave party. And they've got to make their pitch, and eventually the government will make a decision. Well, it now seems that the Vote Leave group is well ahead. They've got £20 million worth of backing. Now, that is not Nigel Farage's group. Nigel Farage of UKIP, he heads a separate Leave Britain, Leave the EU group. But it looks as if Vote Leave will probably become the official group for the Vote Leave, the Vote to Come Out campaign. And you can see there that almost the hand of Providence, because Nigel Farage, although he talks a lot of common sense, he's a very divisive character. You know, although he's got an argument, he puts it over in a very divisive way. But it looks as if he won't have the main Vote Leave campaign. It will be this group. So even that, you know, is quite significant. Right, well, overhead there, a recent article. New record is 300,000 EU workers enter UK in a year. Well, it's staggering. Because a year ago, Mr. Cameron said, well, we'll definitely get it to under 100,000. No problem, he said, we'll definitely do it. Well, it's completely failed. It's more than ever. 300,000 more people have come into the country, most of them from Eastern Europe, than have left. It's colossal. It's like building a new city of Bristol every 3 years. It's absolutely colossal. And of course, the proposal to stop free movement of peoples across borders in the EU, for instance from Romania and so on, and Bulgaria, well, that is the main cause of this enormous immigration. But Cameron, this proposal to stop the free movement of peoples is the one thing above all that the British people want, but it's the one thing above all that David Cameron hasn't put in his proposals that he sent to Donald Tusk for a renegotiation of Britain's relationship with Europe. He dared not put it in because he knew that if he did, it would be shot down in flames, especially by Angela Merkel. So that condition, which most people in Britain would want, does not feature in the new conditions. And there, of course, at the side there, you've got one of the borders being closed in Slovenia, as this great tide of refugees comes into Europe without any real control. It's a very, very big problem, causing big problems, especially for Germany and others. So, there's a picture. I hope you can see what it is. It's actually, I've called it the human tide. It's a tide of people passing through Slovenia on their way to Germany. The great human tide. It's been engineered, of course, by the collapse in Syria, when 2 million people have left Syria because of the war there. Now, at the moment, you can see what kind of a problem it is. 10,000 a night are crossing into Germany. 10,000 a night! Not a month. Well, you don't have to have a degree in maths to work out that 365 times 10,000 comes to 3.65 million. And that would be in Germany alone, besides France and all the other countries. So you see, really, it's a problem that is utterly out of control. Of course, as far as we're concerned, it's okay at the moment, because the million that are in Germany at the moment, they haven't been given passports. But even when they are, they could get up sticks and move straight away, and they could say, okay, we're going to the UK. You could get a million people upping sticks and coming into the UK. It's as serious as that. So, it's a big problem. Right, well, renegotiation, which was first mooted a couple of years ago, before the last general election, before the great earthquake of May the 14th, a couple of years ago, that, David Cameron and Angela Merkel discussing together, and they started to discuss Britain's terms, and Britain wanted a change in the terms, but of course the actual terms weren't made public, but it was just the fact that David Cameron says, look, we want some changes. Things can't go as they are. So Angela Merkel, the Iron Lady of Germany, the newspaper article says she will have the last word. Well, she might not have the last word, because she might not be there much longer, because there's tremendous pressure building up in Germany from right-wing parties to get rid of her. Even people high up in her own government have said this just can't carry on. And so there's big pressure in Germany building up to get rid of her. And they'll end up with somebody who's a lot, shall we say, right-wing and stronger. But so let's think of Britain's proposals of renegotiation, which were sent to Mr. Donald Tusk, who was president of the Council of Europe, 2 weeks ago. There were four points that David Cameron raised that we wanted. One, Britain's access to the single market to be protected. Two, the EU to become much more competitive and red tape, etc., to be abolished. Britain to be exempted from the necessity for coming to an ever closer union, which was enshrined in the original Treaty of Rome. And free movement of people, now this is the nub, free movement of people to be amended with no benefits until people were resident for 4 years. Now that's the only, it's the only thing that David Cameron has put forward to try and stop, or amend, not stop, because it wouldn't stop. It wouldn't stop anybody coming in, really, to amend this human tide. So withdrawal of benefits until they're here for 4 years. But it's very, very likely that this will not pass with the European states anyway, because the 27 other states have got to agree to it. And if only one disagrees, well, that's it. So I can't even see David Cameron pulling that one off. And of course, the elephant in the room is that he hasn't put, look, we want an end completely to free movement. We want control over our borders. And of course, the only way we can get control of our borders is to up and out. That's the only way we can do it. In the end, of course, as I say, it will be the decision of the British people. So, in a sense, that caption there is not quite right. Merkel will have the last word. It might be Merkel's successor in the short term, but ultimately, the British people will have the last word. And it's going to be fascinating to see how things work out. This referendum could come as early as June next year, but there again, it might not happen until about October, September 2017. And as I say, we don't know We don't know what the will of God is concerning this, but we can just see the way that things are running. Right, well, see, Britain is quite prosperous at the moment, isn't it? It's a prosperous country, coming out of the recession and so on, becoming very prosperous and production increasing and so on. But the rest of Europe is in quite a state of turmoil. And in some of the EU states, there is a lot of unrest. For instance, in Portugal, the headline is "Austerity upset in Portugal has caught Europe's elites off guard." Or that was 2 weeks ago. Well, what's happened is that there's been a general election in Portugal, and a socialist coalition won 52% of the votes. But the president of Portugal refused to let them take power. Well, of course, that couldn't last, could it? So last week, they took power, but they're an anti-EU party. They want to throw overboard the EU Stability Pact. They're not happy with Brussels. They want a lot of Brussels powers retracted. So basically, an anti-Brussels, anti-European party has seized control in Portugal. But it's not only in Portugal, because the same things happened in Poland. And that happened 3 weeks ago in Poland, 1st of November. Fresh defiance from Poland could help us reboot the EU. And so what's happened in Poland is that the Conservative Law and Justice Party defeated the party which has been in power in Poland for the last 10 years. And once again, they are very anti-Brussels. They absolutely don't want to join the euro, whereas the other Polish government had got plans eventually to do that, but absolutely don't want anything to do with the euro, and they want a lot less to do with Brussels, and they want a lot more of their own power. So you're starting to see with these peripheral nations, a lot of them are not happy with the way that Europe is being run, and are attempting to break away, if you like, and set their own agenda. So Britain is quite a prosperous country now, compared with the Eurozone, and that's the state really that the Eurozone, and that was a year ago, Eurozone stranded in slump, and it's still the same. It's still in a depression. I've got a couple of facts here noted down here. There were a lot of things in these articles, but for instance, the Italian economy, after being in the EU for years, is now smaller than it was 15 years ago. And taking Germany, for instance, although Germany has racked up huge trade surpluses, its retail sales over the last 10 years have been virtually flat. So, you know, Europe and the euro has not really been a success story, but meanwhile Britain is racing ahead away from them. And Britain, of course, was always a trading nation, and quite an important visit there about 3 weeks ago. The prince and princess, the duchess there, with the Chinese president. China may build own nuclear plant in Essex. Now, Britain has absolutely pulled the stops out with this visit. It's completely, what shall we say, un-European. You can see there Britain as a global trader. The Chinese are actually going, now listen to this, they're bringing in £40 billion worth of resources. £40 billion pounds worth of investment. Chinese shares will be traded on the London stock market, unlike anywhere else in Europe. So you've got this Britain as a global trader, they're very much looking beyond its shores. And of course, there was another visit last week, Mr. Modi, the Prime Minister of India, and of course they've pulled all the stops out for him. It was to all intents and purposes a royal visit. The only thing he didn't get was the royal carriage ride, you know, into London. But he got everything else. He got dinner with the Queen, the Prime Minister fee-fated him. And because, well, it's one of the old young lions, isn't it? It's one of the young lions. It'll be there. It'll be there in Ezekiel 38. There it is. And we've still got this affinity, haven't we, with India. And so, yes, you can see here Britain as the trader. But, you know, Britain really has got nothing to fear from leaving Europe, because 24 of the 27 members, 28 member states do more trade with Britain than we do with them. So they've got a trade deficit with us, 24 of them. The only countries that haven't got a trade deficit with us are Luxembourg, Ireland and Malta. So we're in a tremendously strong position if the people of England do vote to leave, to negotiate tariff-free borders. No way Mercedes and Volkswagen are going to lose their biggest market in Europe. They'll want tariff-free access to Britain, and we'll get it. We're in such a strong position. So yes, in all these things that are happening, you can see Britain as the global trader. As I said, we'll have to wait and see which way it goes. Because ultimately, and this is an old slide, it's an old slide from 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, when we had the first Greek bailout. But this is where Britain and Europe are going to diverge, finally. And it's prophetic, this is prophetic. So the article says, one nation under Germany. It was three and a half years ago. I'll just read the caption. With Greece in meltdown, fears are growing that the euro will collapse. But the historian Neil Ferguson expects the opposite. He tells Ben Lawrence, the currency will survive and the crisis will leave Berlin heading a federal Europe. That's the way it's eventually going to go. As we see in Revelation 17, the great Germanic beast rising. Britain eventually at some point isn't part of it. What point that is, as we say, we don't know. But what wonderful things we're seeing, brethren and sisters. And so, of course, the end result is Ezekiel 38, isn't it? And the young lions coming to the aid of the Tarshish power and trying to defend Israel. So that's going to be the end of it. Right, well, we'll come on to Russia now. So we need to go to Ezekiel 38, don't we? So let's go to Ezekiel 38. We'll perhaps look at our key map. We won't read much of Ezekiel 38 because you know it very well, don't you? But we'll just go into verses 1 and 2. And the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him. And as I've mentioned before, that phrase, the chief prince, in verse 2, is actually translated by the Revised Version as the prince of Rosh, Meshech and Tubal, Rosh, R-O-S-H. There's Rosh on that map there, the ancient nation of Russia, the most ancient way by which Russia was described. And so there you've got the Ezekiel 38 nations there, prince of Rosh, Meshech, Moscow, Magog, Germany, Goma, France, Togarmah, Turkey, and Tubal, Siberia, Tobolsk, and then the Muslim nations which are with Russia in Ezekiel 38, Persia, Ethiopia and Libya, and of course Tarshish and Sheba and Dedan were opposed to the Northern Confederacy. So we know that well enough, don't we? So, yes, let's go on to Mr. Putin, of which we've heard quite a lot this year. We've heard quite a lot from him today. I didn't realise, actually, that there he is about 3 years ago when he was inaugurated as his presidency in the great restored cathedral in Moscow, restored at enormous cost with acres of gold leaf and gold. no expense spared. I didn't realise, actually, that he's already been leader of Russia for 16 years. That's amazing. He's an absolute dictator. He's an autocrat. Many of his opponents have been murdered. Litvinenko, the chappy who stood up against him in an election about a year ago, was mysteriously murdered at a bridge in Moscow, where mysteriously the video cameras were not working. He was killed, obviously on the orders of Putin. He's absolutely ruthless. He rules Russia with a rod of iron, and well, my Dr. Thomas have said that this here describes the autocrat of all the Russians. He says that's what the language implies. Well, we've got to go wind the tape back 18 months. We used to wind tapes back in the old VHS. I've still got a few VHS tapes. So we've got to wind the tape back. The reason for that is, going back 18 months, and Russia was a completely different country. It was prosperous, powerful, got very little debt, in a superb position. Oil was pumping out at $116 a barrel. Russia was accepted amongst by America and all the other great nations. This is going back to February, March 2014. But of course, after the invasion of the Crimea, all that changed. The invasion of the Crimea in February, March 2014. So there we are. There's the Ukraine, and there's the Crimea, which is almost an island, isn't it? It's just joined to the Ukraine proper, with just on this by this narrow stretch of land. And of course, at the bottom of the Crimea, you've got this very, very important strategic port, Sevastopol, which for 200 years has been Russia's prime naval port of the Black Sea. Well, that was all very well until the year 1990, when we had the collapse of Russia. And of course, when we had the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Ukraine became a separate, independent country. Now, hitherto, it was like Worcestershire and Warwickshire. And so it was in the 1950s. Khrushchev gifted the Crimea and Sevastopol to the Ukraine, because he looked back in history and he realised that the Russians had done terrible things to the Ukrainian people, and he wanted to make amends. So he said, right, you can have Crimea and Sevastopol. And he signed this piece of paper, and it passed through Parliament. But as I say, it didn't mean anything, because it was Warwickshire, Worcestershire. Didn't mean anything at all, really. But when the Soviet Union fell apart in 1990, suddenly Russia was devoid of its important Black Sea port of Sevastopol, and it had been a Russian possession for 200 years. And 90% of the people that did live there actually were Russians, it has to be said. And so, of course, we know what happened. Putin goes on the march and seizes it. Not only did he seize the Crimea and Sevastopol, he also seized 140 ships of the Ukrainian Navy, and he still got them. That was quite something, wasn't it? Absolutely ruthless. And of course, it's so important, isn't it, for Russia, because take a line southwest from Sevastopol, and you're down the Bosphorus, through the Bosphorus, through the Dardanelles, on into the Med, and then to Tartus in Syria. So very important. So yes, so after that, of course, sanctions were imposed on Russia, but they weren't very serious sanctions. The EU said, well, we made up a list of these officials, right? Those officials can't travel in Europe. And I think they came up with about 50 names. But the sanctions, they didn't really mean anything. Until a catastrophic event. That was one of the sanctions. Work on key gas pipeline to halt as EU punishes Russia. That's the South Stream line, gas pipeline, which comes from Russia across the Black Sea and was scheduled to go through Bulgaria. So the EU said, right, stop. You can't lay that pipeline now through Bulgaria, Mr. Putin. Well, they thought, this'll work, this'll ruin him. Ah, well, Putin got a plan B. And so what he does, he diverts the South Stream gas pipeline. He wasn't going to go there to Bulgaria, you see. He diverts it south through Turkey and on to Greece, completely nullifying the EU sanctions. So, that was that. And of course, in the meantime, of course, Russia negotiated with Cyprus and obtained permission, and there, I hope you can see a little bit of Cyprus there, pointing to Nicosia, I think, there. That's one of the two ports in Cyprus that Putin has negotiated that Russian warships can now anchor there. And of course, the irony of it is that the RAF bases, Akatiri and Decalia, are just here. So they're eyeball to eyeball, the British looking at the Russians, but it's such an important base, isn't it, Cyprus? It's, for Britain, it's the best aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean. Right, well, then this catastrophic event happened as regards Russia, because the US said, right, Mr. Putin, and the catastrophic event, of course, was the shooting down of flight MH17 over the Ukraine by a Russian missile fired by Ukrainian separatists, but they were all supplied by Russia. Dreadful carnage, over 200 people killed. 200 people of all different nations, Australians, I think there were some Americans, French. Suddenly, everything changed. Right, says America. We'll put financial sanctions on you, Mr. Putin. And, of course, the American Securities and Exchange headquarters has got tremendous power. And so they said, right, no European or banker or bank anywhere can now lend any money to Russia. It's banned. And no bank dared to do so, because if they did, they knew that they'd lose their US trading license. For instance, BNP Paribas, they tried to circumvent sanctions with Iran, US sanctions against Iran. But they wired money to Iran through America, and they were fined by the US $950 million for that one offence. The French protested, and the US said, well, you've got a choice. Either you pay up, or BNP's operations in America are finished. We'll withdraw your banking license. So that has caused a financial collapse now, which is ongoing in Russia. It's been a game changer completely. It's the sanction of all sanctions. No international credit can now flow into Russia, and gradually Russia is facing absolute bankruptcy. So they're in a very, very serious situation. Well, a little bit there about the oil price. That's an old slide. I'm glad it is old, because it shows us a lot of the picture about oil. Daily Telegraph, Tuesday, October the 14th, 2014. It's about a year ago, isn't it? Oil to slide below $80 as OPEC keeps pumping. And now you can see how this has moved. So it says here,
$77, level to which price of oil could now drop. $87, price of a barrel of oil in London yesterday, that is 12 months ago. $115 a barrel, price of Brent crude as recently as June 2014. Well, you can see it's collapsed a lot more even than the dire predictions here. Oil to slide below 80. Well, now, today it was 44. It's nearly half from a year ago. Well, of course, this is absolutely catastrophic for Russia, because Russia relies on oil and gas for half its income. Not 10% of its income, half of it relies on it for half its income. So it's got a double whammy here. The oil price has halved, so his income's halved, but all loans from European banks are banned. So he's between a rock and a hard place. So the story continued from that point. 3 months on from there, last Christmas, plunging oil price raises pressure on Putin's Russia. I'll just read you the first paragraph. Oil arguably brought an end to the old Soviet Union, and once again the price of crude is proving to be a curse for the Kremlin. The precipitous drop in oil prices recently has left Vladimir Putin's Russia on the edge of economic ruin. Their words, not mine. Well, that article was printed when oil was $60 a barrel. Well, he faced economic ruin then. Well, now it's only 44. He faces even more economic ruin. So you can see the dreadful position that that Russia is in. But despite the fact, despite his parlous financial situation, somehow Putin can find money to spend even more money on weapons. And he has, and I'll tell you this, they're very modern weapons. You've got a tank there which can outshoot anything that the West's got. He's got aircraft. You might have seen this in the last 2 days. There was one strike aircraft which can shoot cruise missiles, which took off from southern Russia, crossed the Bosphorus, went to Gibraltar, turned around at Gibraltar and fired two cruise missiles at Gibraltar into Syria. Now just think of the range of that. And these aircraft are so modern, they're fitted with all the very latest electronic devices. They can actually out-jam any US or British or even French plane. The technology is absolutely unbelievable. So he's got no money, he's finding it from somewhere. He's upped the budget on arms for 15%, by 15%. So there we are. It's the way things are going. And we can see why that Ezekiel 38 situation is going to arise, can't we? This updates it up to a fortnight ago. Russia retreats to self-sufficiency as poverty looms. Now, note that word. Poverty. That's the word used by the correspondent. He talks about poverty for Russia. They're having to ban a lot of imports, a lot of food imports, a lot of machinery imports. They are in a parlous economic state. And their present economic plan is based on oil at $50 a barrel for the next 3 years. Well, it's already below 50 at 44. But of course, the nub of the argument is, if Iran gets the nod from the United States to start pumping oil, some believe the price could drop to $30, which would pretty well wipe out Russia. So, you know, we can see the way things are going, can't we? Well, my next section is entitled Syria, Russia, ISIL and Iran. I can see the clock is going faster than me, but never, we'll see what we can do. I thought I'd put that in because that's quite, it's got a lot of pathos in it, isn't it? That was yesterday's article. end of 3,000 years of history after escape of the last Jews of Aleppo. You might have seen pictures of Aleppo. It was once the greatest city in Syria. Now it's basically a heap of hardcore. Hiding in all that rubble was a Jewish family. The Israelis have managed to get them out. But now there are only 18 Jews left in Syria, all of those in Damascus. The Jews and Israel in particular are facing very difficult times. And it's a terrible thing, but since September, 17 Israeli citizens have been killed. 17 have been killed since September. Have you seen it on the television? Have you read it in the newspaper? No. But that's the violence now that the ordinary Israeli citizen, civilian, is now facing. Dreadful violence and anti-Semitism. Right, well, on to first of all Syria. Here you're really looking at Syria as the king of the north territory, because here it is, Syria. And in Daniel 11 we've got a chapter which lists 2,300 years of history of wars between the king of the north and the king of the south. Now historically, the king of the north has always held Syria and the king of the south has always held Egypt. And so what you're seeing now in the Middle East is this now coming into fruition. Now, Russia has actually been supporting Syria for the last 4 years because of those two bases at Tartus and Latakia. Is Assad winning the civil war in Syria? Well, of course, he's been losing it. He's lost, that's a slide from 2 years ago, and he's lost 80% of his territory. So Russia steps in, and I also have to move on because we're practically out of time. What happened finally 8 weeks ago was that Assad's army, most of it had taken flight of foot and gone to Europe. So an army of 300,000 men ended up as 80,000 men. So he has a message from Assad: look, Mr. Putin, unless you come and help me, I'm finished. I'm finished. Well, Putin wasn't going to neglect his ally. He wasn't going to lose those ports of Tartus and Latakia. So, 6th of September, Russia setting up air base in Syria as Putin escalates Moscow's role in civil war. And so there we've got it. I'll have to finish in the next three or four minutes. Russia launches airstrikes in Syria, but ISIL may not be target. Yes. So, but you see, the big difference is now is that for the last 4 years, Putin was backing Syria with money and hardware, but now he's physically there. He's physically in Syria. The king of the north is now in Syria. And that's a very great sign, because of course, sadly we haven't got time to go to it, but in Daniel 11, you've got the king of the north in position. And so thanks and smiles there from Assad, thanking Putin there 6 weeks ago. Look there at ISIL. What's ISIL done? Well, actually, ISIL basically, by parceling up Iraq, has brought Russia into the Middle East. We've got the Russian plane shot down there by ISIL. A payback there. Finally, we've got, of course, the dreadful events in Paris, a cool, ruthless, coordinated plan of attack. Well, of course, that's ISIL in retaliation for French bombing of Syria. But it brings to mind the Luke 21, doesn't it? Men's hearts failing them for fear, for looking at the things which are coming upon the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. And finally, We'll have to stop now, I know, because of lack of time. But, of course, it's brought David Cameron and Hollande together. So you've got the French and the Russians and the US all now united against ISIL. So they become Putin's allies. So there we are. We can see... we just have to stop now because of time. But yes, God has indeed been working, hasn't he, in the kingdoms of men. We've seen what's been happening in Merchants of Tarshish and Syria. Russia is now in Syria. Finally, though, I'll just leave you with this thought. The great sign that the Lord Jesus Christ gave to the disciples, that he said, when you see Jerusalem compassed with armies, you know that the desolation is near. We've got a sign here. We can see now the Prince of Rosh in Syria, the King of the North in Syria. What a sign. So, brothers and sisters, let us look up, for our redemption draws nigh, and pray that the Lord will soon come and restore all things.